Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. I have been a little bit under the weather recently. I am back on the road here, traveling here this next couple of weeks. So just trying to get my act together. It's been super cold here in central New York. I don't know what today is, but I'm sure the wind chill's got it down to below zero, and it's been like that, and we've gotten a ton of snow. There's a couple areas that have gotten almost every day 6 to 10 inches of snow, so there's feet in the North Country. That makes anybody who's doing work in those areas tough. I've had to cancel a couple of visits just because of snow. In the past few years, I haven't had snow as a predominant factor in, you know, scheduling visits, but, you know, that happens from time to time, so I have to move some folks around. So hopefully everybody on the schedule is patient. That's about it for that. The other pieces I want to get at, the other bits of data here is almost out of chestnuts. So if you want chestnuts, again, they're at my location here in Tully, New York. You get to have a chance to come meet with me, get to give you some stuff. Great price on chestnuts. If you want to order over 40 chestnuts, I'll drop the price to about $10 a piece. That's really affordable. It's, I don't know, 70% off what you're going to pay for a 5-6 foot tree. So I take advantage of that. I don't think I'll be doing this again, but it's just a chance for me to share with you all and have everyone, you know, kind of benefit from the cost savings that I was able to achieve. So, you know, I'm just doing it out of, you know, kindness to everybody. And I hope I can share and connect people. And again, planting trees is fun. And it's one of my favorite things to do, although my kids don't, I don't think they appreciate it as much as I do. So there's that. I've been shifting around some ideas in my head, and I'm working with a few guys that will probably come on this podcast. Not anything to do with really the consulting side of things, but just looking at landscapes a little bit differently. When I started writing down this morning, you know, different topics I want to get into, I met with a couple clients of mine, and they're really struggling with population management. And in some of these areas where I work, you know, there's the local DNR hasn't done a great job, in my opinion, of focusing on the right techniques to managing those populations. A lot of it's very buck-centric, and I have a hard time getting my head wrapped around why they've gone to these kind of archaic methods for managing populations where they're only shooting bucks in certain areas, and it baffles me to some degree. And so some topics on that, how to increase deer populations in light of those circumstances. I've worked with clients to do that, so taking pretty complicated issues and even working with properties that are less than a few hundred acres and seeing a pretty large increase in the number of deer that you can create on these smaller properties. So it is possible to do all that. You just have to have a really kind of mindful approach to deer management, population, habitat balancing, all those things that kind of come kind of with this this profession, I guess. So that's it. And what I'd ask for anybody, if you really want some dying topics, like things that are like, you know, hard on your mind that you want me to hit on, more than welcome to do that. I'm going to do an anatomy of a food forest. I'm going to talk about mistakes of building bedding areas. Those are some of the things on my list that I want to get out here this winter so we can help some folks out before they start getting out in the field and cutting. And I want to tell you one thing. Before you have a logger come onto your property, please, please, please have an idea and plan of what you're going to do. So the same thing applies to a forester. I've worked with multiple foresters over the past several years, and you know, a forester's approach is going to be a little bit different from my approach, but have somebody that's educated enough to know, you know, the whole process of, you know, identifying trees to extraction, to what it's going to look like in an aftermath situation. I think this is all really critical when you're thinking about designing your hunting property. So just be mindful of all the steps that are needed to take and be part of the process. Don't sit on the sidelines. I think that's a mistake that folks are making, but just don't jump in logging. Type one mistake, in my opinion. And I've just walked on a property recently where that was the case. Yep, they said, hey, it's hot, I need money, and I'm going to go. Well, if you do need money, that's one thing. But I would say pause and think about that a little bit more. And you know, that's why there's guys like me here to help you, and I can connect you with a forester if you feel more comfortable in that respect, et cetera. So just take your time. Another reminder is Perry Batten is supporting Whitetail Landscapes, and he's working in the Midwest. He's out of Illinois, Missouri area, but he's supporting parts of Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, Kentucky, parts of Tennessee. You know, that's kind of his core region. So if you want support in the Midwest, Perry's available. You just need to reach out to me through my website, whitetaillandscapes.com, or john@whitetaillandscapes. There's also contact forms on each page. If you're looking to have him work on your property this year and consult, this is the time to get a hold of him. We had a bunch of inquiries the other week, and we're just trying to follow up with everybody and get his schedule set for this season. So again, if you could reach out at the john@whitetaillandscapes.com et cetera, through the website, we'll get Perry on board and available to support you. All right. Well, Mark Haslam's back. It's been a bit for him. He's from the southeast portion of the U.S. I'm in the northeast portion, so we have drastically different weather conditions. So I'm interested to see how he's doing. I think he's had a really successful hunting season, which has pretty much been his staple every single year. And I want to hear a little bit more about some of the strategies behind, taking data. He's been on this podcast before, and I think they're just important piece of it. He's got a big property that he's managing, and they're very smart on how they extract, take deer, take vital information, and just have a plan of attack every single season. And again, he's proven his success with the amount of deer that they've killed and the quality of deer that they've killed. And I think their results speak for themselves. So let me get Mark on the line. Hey, Mark, how are you doing?
John, how are you? Happy New Year.
Good, man. Happy New Year. How's your day going today? Are you quite busy?
I'm back to work. I'm trying to catch up on some things after the Christmas New Year break and trying to get a jump start before Monday comes.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm on the road here for the next few days, so I'm just trying to recover a little bit and just had a lot of people getting sick, and I think it's something to do with the weather changes and being around people. I don't know if I got sick from the gym or my kids. Who knows at this point?
That's right.
I want to ask you for a second. Now, we know you have a big property. I know it takes a lot of effort and strategy on your part to make sure you're making good decisions. And we've had many podcasts on this topic. Particularly, I focused on you because I think you're doing a good job of applying some of the deer management principles that some of us are more aware of than others, but almost like a scientific method for evaluating harvest. I mean, I know there's a process that you go through. You're evaluating kidney fat, which I think is really important. And we look at these stack factors of, bone marrow, internal fat, external fat. And you kind of, when a deer starts to lose weight, it extrapolates that through kind of the reverse, where it's losing its rump fat, its back fat into its internal organs, and then its marrow. And one of the techniques I know you use is look at kidney fat. You measure fetuses, and so you're looking at all the vital rates and losses with deer, and you kind of have to understand the population. And I think for a lot of people, it's just hard putting your head around that and having a strategy. And I know there's not a perfect answer to that, but when you're starting out and you're trying to get your grip around how many deer to shoot or what to do or, what's appropriate, you got to have like a baseline. So what would you recommend for somebody who's starting to work on their property, they're starting to come up with a management objective, and they're starting to come up with an idea of how do we maintain a decent population? Obviously, habitat's carrying capacity is part of that. How many deer can we hold on the landscape? And without totally degrading it, how would you start?
Well, if someone was just getting rolling on some management on their land, or maybe they just took over, just made a purchase, or just started off, I would, first and foremost, I would say that just trying to get a plan and implement it, but it's going to take some time. And you're not going to be able to figure it out within a year. You can start to make strides, but it's going to be a gradual process. And I say that because you can get some really good information. I heard you talk about on the intro, some government agencies trying to get help with population control. And you can find some pretty good information, I think, at a state level, at least in the Southeast, where I pay attention to. But it's not going to be localized. It's going to be a blanket, population, herd dynamics across the state. And it's not going to be localized to your own property. So, I would probably, if you have contacts with some neighboring property owners, maybe reach out to them. But start off running some trail cameras. Now's a good time, kind of end of the season or postseason, depending on where you are. I know some states are still running in the January, February, but run some population survey cameras. Now and then do it, you know, keep it going, but definitely do it now and then do it the summer and early fall. See what you're looking at. See what your doe numbers are. There's going to be people. There's some areas of the South where people really can't shoot enough does every year. They're not going to shoot enough. And there's a certain brush where you take so many harvests on any given property, and you just can't get above that because of the pressure. But there's some areas in that same state, wherever you are, where you don't really need to shoot that many does. You need to shoot a handful. So it's really isolated. And the more you work on a property, the more you'll understand your immediate area. You know, is it mostly timber? If there's a lot of heavy timber rotation in timber harvest, start to pay attention to the surrounding, you know, several miles. And if you're seeing in my area of South Carolina, which is really, I'm in the Midlands, but from the Midlands down to low country and over in Georgia, there's been a lot of timber rotation over the past 5 years, over the past 10 years. And when you see that, you see a lot of clear cuts, and then you see a lot of reforestation. And that clear cut, if it's left to grow up wild or it's reforested, replanted pine trees, it's going to be a thicket for about, you know, after 1 or 2 years for the next probably 10 or 15 years. And so you might have these large sections where it's just massive thickets. They're going to hold deer, and those deer are going to be hard to hunt. And some of these tracks, people don't hunt, but I would start running some survey cameras and see how many does you're really looking at. And, you know, keeping tabs and keeping a log when you hunt, observational logs. And, when you harvest, just, you know, like what you said, take notes of what you're seeing. Extract the jawbone, estimate the age, take the weight, and start to get a baseline knowledge as far as how much do your yearling 1 year old does weigh. And late season takes about 30 days after they're bred. So in most states, you can, if you're able to hunt does late, you can see when they were bred. So you know, typically you would want a yearling to be pregnant and have, you know, one fetus. A lot of times you'll have a fawn doe that'll be pregnant, you know, their first fall, which is a good sign of habitat. But a fawn or a yearling have one fetus, and then from there, two fetuses from, you know, 2 year olds and up. And occasionally you'll have some triplets. But really, as far as how many does you shoot, it's going to be based on what you're seeing out there on cameras. And then the other side too is your habitat. If you can't grow a food plot of a decent size, and decent size is all relative, but if you're having trouble planting a food plot that's at least a 1 acre or more, you might have too many deer. But that's all relative and subjective to your own property. What else do you have available for food? But it's kind of a whole package that you got to, you know, wrap up. And for a lot of people, even like us, you don't want to go into it the first couple of years just blasting does. You want to kind of take your time. But over a period, you can start to see trends. You know, are you getting a lot of bucks on camera throughout the summer and fall, or even throughout the fall, but you're not seeing them on the stand. You're not seeing them, but all you're seeing is does. If you're seeing 10 to 12 double digit does for every buck you see, you probably have more does. So it's a fine balance. But the more data, like one more thing I'll mention, John, is that when you can establish a fawn recruitment rate, and that you can get from, you know, trail cameras and the observations on the stands, if you can get a baseline of fawn recruitment, which in the South, and I can't shoot from Northeast, but that'll fluctuate from about 25%, maybe 40%, or 50% fawn recruitment, you know, that fawns that survive through the fall, our property is about 40-50%. Then you can get an estimate of how many fawns are surviving based on how many does you have. And then you kind of factor in a 10% annual mortality, which is what most biologists say. And then you can run, you know, you can very quickly have a model to say, well, here's my estimated density per square mile, and here's how that factors into my property, and it could be 300 acres. And I got 10% mortality, and then I've got a replacement of new deer that are coming in, a fawn. So then how many should I take? And that, you know, that model might take you a couple of years, but that's something that you can work towards.
Yeah, I think, you know, we would try to say that would be like a sustainable model, because it likely takes in multiple factors. I think there's the idea sometimes where land managers jump in, they have this observation, and they just see a lot of deer. They may see a lot of does, or maybe a lot of bucks for that matter, and they just react. They don't take the time, and I think that's the piece that I think is critical, is taking some time before you just jump in and make rash decisions. And realize this too, like all these properties are connected. And so like a bad decision over on one property can affect you, and a good decision on another property could affect you, vice versa. So it's kind of understanding the entire dynamic. Even if you have a large property, like we're talking here, you're still impacted by the conditions around you. And then you have to be vigilant in trying to build those relationships to ensure that you're not doing something that's either going to tilt the scale a little bit in a negative, right? And so you just got to be more conscious of that. And I think that's one thing that I've seen in these small blocks of timber. Nobody's really working together in synergy, and everybody thinks, you know, they're kind of on an island, and they're not. And objectively, they're trying to figure out, you know, a set quota of deer to kill every year. What I also know, and I think this is something that I think folks struggle with, is you do all these improvements on your property, then all of a sudden you get, I call it deer swamping. You know, these deer just, you know, crowd in on these properties, and then you have this overabundance of deer, which I'm sure you've experienced this. And then you're in a different situation where there's an exorbitant amount of deer, and you're trying to do a population study, and every year you're just, not just your, you know, your recruitment of deer, you know, could be high, but then the influx and immigration of deer increases significantly. And you've got these, you know, mass population of deer where, you know, a property adjacent may have 50 deer per square mile, and you have 250 deer per square mile for that matter. Has that ever been a factor in your scenario? And, you know, have you had to deal with that at all?
Yes, we have. Yeah. And I would, to your point, I agree that you just got to take it slow. And when I talk about localized deer intel and about not like blanketing your entire state, localized is going to be like your section, might even be like your township, you know, but, you know, outside your little town in the county, not even countywide. So, and I do see that. We acquired a property next to us. That added them about 500 acres to our piece. And that 500 acres, it's probably close to 40%, ag fields, agricultural fields. And the rest are these, a clear cut over that's been left to grow up for about 8 years, big thickets, and then some isolated timber blocks that are, little kind of bottoms and whatnot that, you know, can't be farmed. And the previous hunters were, have a lease, and they didn't shoot those. They just, you know, kind of casually hunted, probably rut and shot some bucks. And that was right next to our piece. And we always had some does coming from the property, but to your point, it was an isolated chunk of land, and there's some surrounding ones around it where people just didn't shoot does. And so you have this kind of mass population that was very very condensed, but it supported those deer because they had a couple hundred acres of ag fields, whether it was typically cotton or peanuts, which they're going to feed on that. I mean, they're still going out to cotton fields long after they've been harvested, and there's still remnants of cotton seed and how much weeds growing up to eat. So there's food, but then they weren't being hunted. And there's these isolated woodlots that no one was pressuring. And so you get the deer concentrated. And that's something I was, you know, mentioning, to kind of understand. I'm not saying go and, you know, knock on the doors of the neighbors, try to get their intel and what they know about their deer herd. But you know, pull up the aerial, as everyone talks about, from a 10,000 foot view, One X or Google Earth, and scroll around, because you can probably see areas that might not be hunted. And in that area, we took out a number of does. I was going very aggressive with it, and this is right next to us. Okay, so on our main property that we've been hunting for a long time, our does. The doe weight on this new property was significantly higher, up about, you know, 10 to 20 pounds heavier. And the ages were older. They were, I mean, I was shooting 3 and 4 and 5 year old does. They were older. The fat was about the same, but they just weighed more and there was more of them. So it and that was right next door.
Wow.
So, and that's really, the fat was about the same. But it's that's what I'm talking about, you know, localized. And so we also have a property down the road. It's maybe 2 miles down the road, right? And it's a little bit different. It's mostly wooded. There's some swamps and creeks. But the ag is a little bit of a walk for deer. If they want to get some of those big ag fields, they're probably walking at least a half mile to close to a mile to it, which they will, but not all the deer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And those deer typically weigh, the bucks are going to weigh 25, 30 pounds less. And the does are going to weigh maybe, you know, 10 or 15 pounds less on average. Antler size will be about the same, but they just weigh less. And our deer population is a little bit less. We have a better buck to doe ratio. We've been hammering the does, but it's a lower deer population. We're only talking about maybe 2 miles away, but it's all relative, you know, to what that specific area is. Because, you know, if you think about it, does only need about like 200 acres as far as their core area. It's really not much. They're not really moving around so much. Postseason, they'll kind of regroup and maybe form a new, they'll kind of join up after some have been shot and whatnot, and they'll form, you know, different doe groups, but they don't really move around that much.
Sure, yeah.
So they kind of seem isolated. Then you got the other factor of, you know, naturally they have these instincts, as we all know, of being, you know, a prey species, a very good survivor. So If there's a nook, if there's a cranny, if there's a, you know, even like 100 acres that doesn't get hunted, which, even though there are hunters everywhere, there's hunters everywhere in the South, there's hunters everywhere in the Northeast, there is still a lot of land that doesn't get hunted.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you are, there is a lot of land, no matter what people think, that doesn't get hunted. And that could be, you know, a stronghold right next to you. So, I mean, you might have one of those properties next to you that holds a lot of deer, or you might be surrounded by people that blast every deer they see. To your point, yeah, I would agree. Population swings can go very heavy, especially thickets. So if your neighbors or some surrounding properties are starting to clear cut and doing different stuff like that, pay attention to it, because the first year or two, it's not going to be much, but a year or two after that clear cut, when it starts to regrow, whether it's reforested yet or it's going to grow out wild, that population is going to start to increase.
It's interesting in the Northeast, specifically my area, where most of the properties locally to me are far below carrying capacity when it comes to the numbers. And the numbers are so low. And again, I should pause here. There needs to be more, I think, analysis done in your individual area. I'm a big fan of trying to get population information together, and in whatever way you can, whether it's helicopter surveys or drone surveys, doing it ethically, generally outside of the hunting season, and using that as kind of a metric data. And you mentioned trail cameras, you know, great resource for everybody, but getting kind of a sense of things. And then, you know, I've done some calculations in my particular area to look at just, you know, quality food and habitat, and gave it weighting factors, and then compared it against my neighbors, kind of a benchmarking scenario, and then looked at what I think the use rates are on my property, and then calculate, you know, how much consumption, and you kind of get into some of the details. But one of the points that you brought up was really interesting, is the fact that within these different formations, probably bad term, but, you know, groups of deer on these isolated properties or individual properties, you're noticing differences in physique, which is unique. It could be a characteristic of the deer that have been existing there or preformed in those areas for periods of time, and potentially relative health in some capacity may be equivalent across the board. You mentioned the kidney fat is likely the same or close to being about the same, but their physique is different, which is really cool. And it just may be, you know, characteristics of those individual deer, like people are quite different in some areas, you know, that may be representative even in like a little microclimate of variation in just physiology. And I've seen that. I've seen areas where there's bucks that are bigger and smaller based on body size. I'm not even talking about antlers at all. Just their physique is different. That's not totally uncommon in a lot of these areas, but I think it's paying attention to a lot of this stuff and making sure that, you know, you're not in this negative feedback loop where your population grows, you're not managing it, and then, you know, something happens drastic, and then all of a sudden, you know, the bottom falls out from population. I've seen populations that have been really susceptible to a lot of different things, and the decisions, the point I was going to get to here is decisions have been made in my areas. They have provided too many permitting options to kill too many deer, and as a result, you know, the populations that were already stressed are even further stressed in the numbers, and it makes hunting way less enjoyable. And, you know, that's what depopulizes or popularizes hunting in a lot of these areas where nobody wants to come into the Northeast to hunt because it doesn't have the quote unquote quality of experience that you might have in the other areas. And it really starts with numbers. I mean, numbers is a huge piece of this. I'd love to have better numbers in some of these particular areas, but you know, on the flip side, when you have too many deer, you know, that's where you really have to be smart about, like you're talking about earlier, is making sure that you're managing that population. But in my case, we're trying to get the population to essentially rebound. And I think that's a little bit different of an extreme issue. And again, we have some density independent factors, like our winter severity is ridiculous here. We've got 60 inches of snow on average right now in my particular, where I live right now. So that's a lot of snow, and that makes, you know, a competition for food harder, and predation rates go up. Deer die for natural causes, like you had mentioned earlier. There's a lot of factors that go into, you know, deer survival that we all just sit back and just wait till next season. We're like, well, I hope that buck survives. It's like, yeah, I think it's, you know, hope is probably, you know, not your best antic to understand what the outcome might be. And I just want to add that to the discussion. Mark, so let's go down this road a little bit further. You mentioned, and maybe we get back to why you think there's some differences amongst those, you know, different doe herds or deer herds, within these individual areas. But you mentioned just keeping like statistics and information. And I just want to know, like, you know, truthfully, everyone thinks keeping data is painful or taking data is painful. And I know you have like your skidding check and you guys set your quotas and you're killing a lot of deer and you're doing some measurements. And you're looking at age classes and comparing them in, you know, size and quality. What have you seen for trends over time? Like, have you seen fat reserves go up? Have you seen them stabilize? You know, does it vary based upon cohort or age of deer? You know, just maybe some interesting information from just data collection that people would find kind of cool when you're trying to make some either decisions or just learning from the data that you're collecting.
Yeah, this is one of the more interesting sides that I enjoy with management. A lot of the data that you collect post harvest is going to be relative to the timing of the kill throughout the season. So, if you were to take any given buck on opening day. So if that opening day in the South is going to be maybe August or September, those statistics, the fat, the weight, it's going to look different than if you were to take that exact same buck at the end of the season. It's going to be significantly different. So you got to keep that in mind. And, you know, some of the stuff that we'll see, you know, as far as does, you know, like what you'd imagine, they're going to have more. The fat's kind of interesting because they probably have the most fat on them in the next couple months going in right before they give birth, right before thorns drop, building that fat back up. But then they're going to start to burn a lot of fat and weight when they don't, you know, going through the summertime, lactation, producing milk. So they're going to burn off a lot of that fat and then sort of kind of put it back on. But it just depends on if you have a lot of does and maybe they're not the superior health, then they're going to struggle some weight-wise going into the fall, coming off giving birth, lactation. And then they're going through the rigors of the breeding season, which it's not just standing around eating until they're ready. They're starting to get bumped by usually like younger bucks or bucks, you know, around pre-rut when they start to kind of get a little, you know, interested or their testosterone starts to spike. So they're getting bumped around by, young bucks, and then they're getting bumped around by hunters. And then they're finally ready to start kind of going through the heat and then be receptive. It's just a lot of, they're burning a lot of extra fat. So when you harvest a doe, it's going to, you just got to keep that in mind. And over a course of a couple of seasons, you'll start to see some trends there as far as what it looks like early, mid, and late season. You know, as far as age, it's kind of what you'd think as far as weight. Our fawn does, if we were to shoot some in, you know, October, November, December, they're going to weigh anywhere from 62 to 78, you know, kind of mid-high 70s pounds. And some of those fawn does, once they reach about like 70 pounds, like 68 or in the mid-70s, they can go through their first heat cycle, which may be as early as early November. Hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be late season right now, going through a second or a third rut, quote unquote. We have taken some late December that were bred early November, and those fawns are probably dropped earlier. So I've had these conversations with biologists, for instance, because it's a sign of good health. It's a sign of good habitat and herd and overall health if you have a fawn that reaches their first heat cycle, their first year. I mean, truly, like they're born in the spring and in the fall they're healthy enough and they weigh enough and they go through the first heat cycle. It's a sign of good habitat and herd health, right? But then is that something you actually want? Do you want, a female deer to be giving birth and dropping a fawn when they're turning one? Is that something that you really want? And it's kind of a conundrum that a biologist says, like, yeah, it's not really something because, you know, they're still learning the ropes and they're still, you know, is that new fawn going to have one foot in the grave? Unless they're in a big doe group where they're kind of learning under a matriarch doe. So it's kind of good health, but at the same time is a mother doe that's 1 year old, a yearling, is she going to be the best mother as far as nutrition, lactation, giving birth? As we know, the 50% of a buck's potential, animal potential is set during gestation. So if she gives birth, it's just a lot of things like that, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I shot a doe a couple weeks ago or a week or two ago before Christmas that was one, a yearling, and she wasn't bred yet. It's interesting. You know, every deer doesn't get bred. As far as bucks, you know, when you start, one mistake we made, and we made it for a long time, so I'm not knocking any hunter, but a lot of hunters make it, is they don't extract the jawbone for a buck. You know, they shoot a big buck and they've had it on trail camera for, they think, 4 or 5 years. And sometimes they do because there's a very unique characteristic about maybe the ear or something truly identifiable. But if you're basing it solely on the antler set, sometimes there's something unique, as you know, And other times it might just be a rack that could resemble many other antler sets. But if you're not pulling the jawbone, you truly do not know the age. And where that can go wrong is that you might have some really good healthy does. You might have some really good genetics on your land, and you might be shooting a really good three-year-old. It might be high-grading a three-year-old that you think is four. And there's nothing wrong with that if you want to shoot it, but if you think it's four, that three-year-old is going to explode when it's four and five, as you know. If you think it's a four-year-old but it's three, that's a deer that if you knew that, you might want to let walk. And then the same point is, you might be seeing some four-year-olds or even five-year-olds that don't seem all that big. You might see a four-year-old that that you think is three, or a five-year-old that you think is three or four. It's like, I'll give another year, especially if it's late season. Because some of these weights can go from 200 pounds down to 160, 170. So they'll look a little thin if you can't judge the body. But when you pull the jawbone, you'll start seeing, you know, we shoot a lot of 4 and 5 year olds, mostly a lot of 4 year olds, and, you know, some fives, a lot of 4 year olds that just aren't that incredibly large. I think they're great deer. I love hunting deer. And so for me, shooting a 4 or 5 year old is just one of the coolest things you can do. And I love that. Okay. But every 4 year old, every buck's not going to grow to be 150 inches. And we shoot, you know, we have a lot of deer that they're not going to have that kind of potential. So when you don't extract the jawbone, you really don't know. Yeah. You don't know if it's a really large 4 year old that you think it's like six. Every taxidermist isn't going to do it, even if you ask. It's really simple to, if you have a caped, whether a processor does it or you do it, to be able to flay and skin back the hide off the snout, and you don't have to cut anything in the hide. It's probably fine. The taxidermist is going to do it. It's just that not many people ask for the jawbone, so they're not used to saving it.
Yeah.
But you can do it yourself. But pull that jawbone and, you know, and see what you're really working with.
Mark, on your primary farm, like what is your approximate, and I know it's an approximation, buck to doe ratio as it stands today? What would you guesstimate it to be?
On the property that we have 2 miles away that I was talking about earlier, in the deer population isn't as intense. It's about 2 to 1 doe to buck ratio. We kind of fluctuate from just below 2 to 1 to kind of 1 to 1. On a main piece, it fluctuates anywhere from 3 to 1 to 2 to 1 doe to buck ratio.
Okay, I thought your doe population on the big farm was a little bit higher than that, but okay, that's good.
It used to be, it used to be a lot higher. It used to be, 4 does for every buck and even more. But for the past 6 years now, we've been really going intense on the doe population, tremendously. And we've seen a big decrease.
Let's talk about the observation piece post this decision to remove the amount of deer that, you know, previously existed on the landscape, specifically focusing on doe and harvest. And was it part of your strategy looking at age class? So 2+ older does, I mean, it's hard for people to age does, but, you know, older age class does in that scenario, like what was your strategy? And then what did you see from an opportunity standpoint? And I think that's where a lot of people struggle. I've got clients here that all they want to do is shoot bucks, and it's an afterthought, yeah, even thinking about shooting does, because why would they kill the next population or repopulation potential? And I also mentioned to them, I'm like, what's your hunting like all season long? And I do mention to them as well, it's like, you know, they're not the only part of the equation for breeding purposes. Bucks, you know, they do serve a purpose in the landscape. So you got to think about, you know, actually breeding opportunities if you don't have the buck population, for that matter. And that is a big situation here where I think people have made major mistakes. But anyhow, that's my issue.
I agree with that. There were two things for us in our decision to go ahead on the deer harvest. One was we were having trouble establishing food plots. And again, it's all relative, but if you're planting a certain amount of acres and then you also have alternative food sources throughout the year, Ehrlich successional, acorns, ag, whatever, you all got to factor that in. But if you're having trouble establishing food plots, which we were, our farmer was also getting a heavy depredation on the crops, where they're having to replant crops. And then the other side to it is that we went through what you were talking about, I think, or alluding to about just targeting these bucks. You know, you get the bucks on camera, maybe summer, early fall, and you name them, and you want to go after these particular bucks, but then you don't see them. Not saying that they disappear off your land, but you just don't see them. You don't shoot them. And after a year or so of doing that, but you're seeing all these, does, maybe small bucks, you got to change something up. And if you have, so many does, these bucks don't have to move. And I know that there's so many different studies out there where you can see these GPS collars on these, interactive maps to show where they're moving and whatnot. And those are great research. But again, it's all relative. And if you have some real dense thickets or some strongholds or swamps or whatnot, these bucks don't necessarily have to move. They are survivors and they're going to kind of eat and hide. And then breeding season is going to come around and they're going to hang around the does. And if there's a big quantity of does, they're not going to fly around and just be showing up everywhere. The less does you have, as your population decreases or a lower population with a tighter buck to doe ratio is going to have better buck movement, better daytime movement than a higher population is. It's just flat out. And there's a ton of research with that. So that was a big decision for us, is that we have these bucks, we're getting on camera, they're staying on the property, we're finding shed antlers, but we're not killing them. We're not seeing them. And at a certain point, John, you're going to grow them, they're going to get large, and then, on average, how long these bucks live. So, for a while there, I was thinking, well, we're not shooting them, we're just going to be crawling with 5 and 6 year olds. That's not how it happens. Hmm. It just doesn't. Because, they're not running your property, but there's also that threshold of, how you're hunting. So just because you might have these bucks doesn't mean they're going to be coming in front of your stands, and that's a whole different topic about how you hunt. But, the more hunts you have, the more pressure you have. But if there's a lot of does, they're not going to be looking around. They're not going to be daylighting. If you got does all over the property, and they're in the thickets, and they're in the food plots everywhere else, they're not going to necessarily go out into a field. So we bit that bullet, and we were shooting some very low numbers of does compared to what we're doing now. Happened, and it was a tough pill to swallow. We kind of eased into it because we had this, thought of we're going to shoot too many, right? It just that's just not, and we've never done that. I mean, we've never shot too many. There's also a threshold of like how many can you shoot. I think people have this fear of like I'm going to wipe it out, but you can only really take so many if you're doing it legal, like during daylight hours.
Yeah.
Pressure-wise and whatnot. And if someone has a hesitation about not affecting the buck hunting and whatever else, every state's different, but down here in the South, at least, in a lot of states, you can start hunting early. If you can, before the rut, try to take those does out as early as you can. Get it out of the way, take some out, and then maybe see how the hunting season goes and maybe try to take some out at the end. And now that way it leaves your rut kind of wide open, because the bucks, what we found is that when we go hard on a doe harvest, when we can mid September, and we try to lay off maybe after 3 weeks, kind of early October, it doesn't affect the bucks. They're not leaving. The does are still there. You give a little bit of a break and that breeding season fires up and they're going to be on the move.
I think it's really good information. I think people should probably re-listen to everything you just mentioned there, because you went through your ups and downs and not costly mistakes, but timely mistakes, because that probably set you back a little bit from a time standpoint. Now, you've had a successful season, so there's two questions I want to ask. I know you probably had a set quota for the does that you were going to kill this year, and I know you're not the only one contributing. There's a whole host of people that, you know, hunt on your property. You guys are managing a lot of that. How many does have you killed so far this year? I'm on the primary property, and maybe it's lesser than years past, but the numbers, what we've talked about in the past, have been pretty big. So it's maybe just a rough number, and then I'll ask you my second question.
We are, as far as doe harvest, we're somewhere in the low 50s.
Okay.
We're talking like 52, 55 does.
I hope everyone realizes how dialed that is and how much effort that takes to shoot 50-something deer. But to your point, now, buck-wise, you've killed how many bucks this season?
I've shot three.
All right, and I think I've seen all three of them. I think you've posted them all. What was your secret to the last deer that you killed? Let's walk through that hunt briefly. I know you're doing some hunting with your kids, too. I see that. But what happened with this last buck? Or actually, you know what? For that matter, out of any of the three that you've killed, maybe dissect something very critical to the success of one of those kills that I think listenership would absolutely benefit from.
Probably this last one. The second one I shot was a lot of fun, how that hunt played out. But probably this last one, which was the Sunday before Christmas, maybe 2 weeks ago or a week ago at this point. And that was in a sanctuary that was a cutover and just left the grunt wild. It's going to be set back at some point soon. But it's just this massive thicket where it's a lot of tall grass and volunteer trees that probably totals maybe 20 to 30 acres, something like that.
Okay.
And there's a road system going through it, like a spine road, basically, and some, you know, offshoots of it. But it holds a lot of deer, right? And I wrote an article about this, kind of a little brief thing, just talking about, you know, sanctuaries. Mm-hmm. And they're very important. And I know you work with your clients on them. And I went through this phase for a long time where, you know, sanctuaries can look different ways, and everyone can't do it, but we have our first sanctuary kind of made sense based on the road system. That's a block. You know, it would designate that. Well, there's a couple things. One, just because I will mention, label something on your map, sanctuary, doesn't mean the deer are going to think of it that way or use it that way.
Yeah, good point.
and we've gone through that because, you know, kind of have to have everything that they need. It can't just be, can't label it. It's got to be, you know, safety and whatnot. So anyways, as everyone knows, listen to this podcast, there's a big benefit from it. And in a sanctuary, something that you leave that's truly a thicket can be outstanding for your property. Funnel deer out, got the season, everything like that. But at a certain point, especially if you have a higher deer population, there's going to be bucks in there, a buck's bed in there, but at a certain size, I mean, if that sanctuary is maybe a couple acres, you know, 2 acres, 5 acres, you might not have bucks in there, but at a certain size, you're definitely going to have bucks in there. You're definitely going to have does and bucks and anything in between. Right. So at a certain point, you know, you need to hunt it. If you have a high deer population, just like what I mentioned before, you might have bucks that just don't move that much. They don't need to. They're smart, they're old, and they don't need to venture off into open spaces to get shot at because there's does everywhere. So I made the decision before Christmas to kind of to basically hunt that area. And it was difficult because of the wind, and we're getting a lot of western winds, and my setup, I needed anything but a west wind, but I just started hunting it and I put up a camera and started getting a couple bucks. Was able to put together a hunt to take one of those bucks on a good trail system through it. But I think one thing I would say is that, you know, if someone has something like that on an area where they don't hunt, you know, towards the end of the season, you ought to hunt it. Because if you go in there, maybe blow it up and spook a bunch of deer, that will resolve itself before next season. They're going to go back in there.
Yep.
But hunting it, you might see. I mean, I was seeing a ton of does when I was in there. I was seeing an incredible amount of does. I was seeing some does, John, that were just hosses. I mean, just cows. Big, I mean, sway backs, big bellies. And I shot some around there around Christmas the same time that were here on this new property I'm talking about that we have right next to us, but no one was shooting does. And they're just a lot bigger and older. But I was seeing, you know, insane amount of deer in there. And you know, observations is something that you got to track, because trail cameras are great, but they only capture what they capture. Even if you put out, you know, bait in front of a corn or feeder, salt lick or whatever it is, every deer is not going to come in front of it. It's just not going to happen. A lot of the deer observation needs to come from the hunter. So if you have an area like this, hunt it. Hunt the perimeter, get in there with the right wind. You're going to bump deer. And that was part of my problem, is I had to wait for the right wind, because if you go into an area like that, you are going to bump deer, because there's going to be deer bedding. You're not sure where they're going to be bedding. But, you know, hunt them. I wouldn't do that before the light. I would probably only do that towards the end of the season. Yeah, I would probably wait to the end of the season for that.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And I actually like the idea. One is a sanctuary that's labeled doesn't mean it's a sanctuary, at least to the deer. And I always like the other point of, you might need to push the limits in order to understand exactly what's going on, to your point with the observation. I love that. All right, I got to ask you a couple more questions before we finish this off. In your food plots, late season, in your particular area, what's your, like, based on the current weather conditions, and I don't know everything that's happening in your particular area, what is the highest preferential food right now on your particular property that you think is creating a draw, at least in your food plots?
For us, we plant oats, and a lot of the people in our general area plant oats.
Okay.
They're fairly inexpensive. They grow quickly with some rainfall, and they just keep on growing. So they can snip them down. But oats is, if you plant some oats, nice little green field, and leave it alone, the deer will be pouring into it.
What time of year did you plant your oats this year?
A little bit later. They should be maybe early October. I think we started late October or early November. The problem that the challenge we have in the South is that if you're planting warm season food plots, you've got that transition of warm season to cool season. And when do you do it? Because the transition, if you do both, it's going to be right in the middle of your hunting season, you know, late September, early October.
Absolutely.
But then, so it's this, so, you know, so then a lot of people say perennials, and that's a great option. There's just a lot more work to it. So that's something that we're trying to get more perennials established, so we don't have that. But that is a problem, because if we can get some soybeans established, which has been very difficult for a number of years with the deer population, those beans can last. You know, the way the foliage, at the first frost, there's a lot of bean pods left. But if we're doing other warm season, they might be kind of cached by late September. But that's something you gotta think about, you know, as far as, you know, hunting. But then it's like, do you want to maximize your food, or do you want to set up more of a killing situation?
Sure.
But oats seem to be, I think it's the best bang for your buck.
Yeah. Easy to plant, easy to establish. You know, it's interesting that you have the issue of like, creating a little bit of chaos, because there's a planting period that overlaps during hunting, but that's kind of this scenario that happens down south. The bean establishment, I know, is really difficult. We've actually talked about that on prior podcasts between you and I. I always find that, you know, that's something that we can establish a lot easier in some of the areas around here, because we don't have those populations. But to your point, I'm sure they would be consuming those pretty heavily coming up. So, you know, what a great resource, if at least if you have standing beans. But again, I mean, it's all in what the deer prefer, and they have a tendency to take advantage of good food sources, especially planted in the summer period, and that's really kind of hard to get over, at least from a strategy standpoint, when you have those total numbers of population. Of course, you still have some farming that's happening on your primary farm, I believe. So I don't think necessarily you guys are planting all the fields, if I recall. I think that's correct. And then quite a bit of burning and strategy there as well. So there's just a lot that goes into managing a farm of that size. And like you said, you've got now other properties that you have to work through. So it's like your whole life seems to be surrounding hunting and being smart about these things. And I mean, the successes, you know, it's been proven. I mean, you've killed quality deer every single year. And I know you're not the only one on the farm killing good deer, but it is impressive to see you doing this, and you're enjoying it with your family too. And that's great to see your kids are coming along with you. And I think that's great.
Yeah. I appreciate that. It's a lot of work, but it's fun. And at a certain point, if things get to be just, you know, if it becomes too much of work, then you need to kind of pause and take a step back and just, you know, reassess and, you know, have fun with it. You know, it should be fun and it should be enjoyment as far as the land, the game. And if it becomes too much work, just kind of slow it down some, because it's not supposed to be. I'm not saying you were saying that, but sometimes it can be.
No, I know. It can be a lot of work. And it's interesting. How do you teach the next generations to enjoy it like you're enjoying it and not have them, you know, kids concentrate on other things. My son's not even that interested in hunting, right? And that's my recent, you know, conundrum, right? And working through that and trying to get him interested in some type of shooting sport for that matter. So at least we can connect, although we golf together. I'm just, you know, fire season's coming up for you. And of course, you know, you're going to be burning, I'm assuming, portions of your property of a rotation. I'm assuming obviously children aren't going to be involved with that, but there's time away from home where you're going to have to put some emphasis on you know, habitat management. And it's now, essentially, you know, it's coming up now. So, I think there's a sacrifice that we all make. And I think that's an important piece of it. And hopefully everybody around us understands that. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding, but it's also, it takes time, and a lot of people just want to hunt and they don't want to do the work. And you and I both know where the work results, right? And that's really, I think, the most important piece of this, you know, strategy when it comes to actually working and coming up with a plan.
Yeah, I fully agree. Well, one other hunt I'd like to mention is there was a buck I was able to shoot, that last week in October. And that's when a lot of our does are going into heat and our early breeding starts. And I won't go into detail about the actual hunt itself, but I'll mention something that I've had conversations with some of my good friends down here that manage land just like me. It's that if someone's not having success seeing bucks on a deer stand, there are a lot of our large bucks on our property are shot with a climber in the woods. Okay. A lot of them are. Typically you can see more bucks, mature bucks, if you're out in the woods climbing on a mobile setup, right? Between the stands.
Sure.
We do see a lot of bucks and shoot bucks every year on permanent stands. But, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, he's, you know, same area, much larger land, but they had the same issue, you know, a long time ago, like, you know, 20, about 10 years ago, where it was the same case, but they reworked how they hunted, reworked their access and whatnot. And now they're seeing and shooting most of the mature bucks on deer stands, on permanent stands. It used to be the opposite. Mm-hmm. They had to get between them. One of the bucks I shot in late October, I was hunting mobile out of a climber. Now, someone follows me, they know, see that I do that a lot, but I swing, when I'm doing that, I'm kind of swinging for the fence. I know where bucks should be. I know what they're doing behavioral wise throughout the season. And I go in the woods, have a general area, find a good tree and climb. A lot of times I don't see anything, but sometimes you do see a buck. But it's just kind of going into next year, if someone's still hunting right now, you need to have permanent stands on food plots. But if someone's able to have some mobile setups going with a pop-up climber or a ground blind or a climber, think outside the box a little bit, because you could be in a situation where you've got the bucks, but they're just, you're going to see more of them outside your permanent stands. And in one way, you might look at that, well, that's a problem. But another way, you can use that to your advantage. But on the flip side, if you don't want to hunt mobile with a climber, you might need to think about how you hunt, where, you know, what your access is, how you're getting in the stand, how you're getting out. Is your stand sticking out like a sore thumb? All that stuff that people talk about, but it's real. And it can drastically affect seeing mature deer, seeing mature bucks. And I think there's also, and, you know, we've seen it, and some of the, going back to some of the data as far as does, I do think that, you know, a lot of the does, some of the does we shoot late season, they're very young. And some of the older does, they're not coming out in these, open permanent stand areas. They've seen a lot. It's towards the mid-late season. And these older does are smart, and they're not going to go, and it's going to be the younger ones. They're going to get shot and then spook everything off. So just, you know, think outside the box and you know, just think about that, is that, you know, just because you're not seeing these bucks, maybe you need to rethink about, you know, how exactly you hunt. Because they're still there, but they're just avoiding, could be avoiding where the hunter is.
Yeah, absolutely. And that happens a lot. And these folks with fixed stands and, you know, preformed setups that are supposed to be dialed, sometimes they get corrupted pretty easy after first several hunts.
Yes.
And again, yes, you know, that just makes the rest of the season that much more difficult. And Mark, this is a crazy adage, but, you know, if a deer catches me in a stand, it dies. You know, that's been my mantra. I would tell every client that story. And again, you know, that's just a strategy that I have. That's my particular advice and opinion on that. But I appreciate all the sharing, your success. And, you know, I think keeping, you know, a lot of information, whether it's, you know, vital information as well as, you know, history and showing, you know, where you're going, you know, your projections towards the future. And, you know, your continued success has a lot to do with the amount of time and effort that you put into making some changes over the years, and not necessarily just, you know, sitting on your laurels and just continuing on and hoping things will get better. And I would ask everybody is to, you know, behaviorally think about, you know, and be influenced by this conversation, that there is a good correlation between positive habitat work and deer interest. And it's your job post that to manage those areas from a maintenance management standpoint, but also think about what you're shooting and thinking about the health and conservation of that population. So, you know, generations next can actually see that better quality going forward. And I think that's part of our jobs as stewards of the land and, you know, just people that are generally interested in this sport and passion. And I just, you know, pronounce that fact to everybody, because it's super important for me to have people around here in my local area start to think different, because I can't be the only guy doing this. I mean, that seems crazy, right? And I know there's other people around me, men and women, that have interest, but we can all be smarter about these things. So hopefully this conversation helped that. So, well, Mark, thanks for taking time out of your day for me. I appreciate you catching up, because we've been going back and forth and I've been traveling, and, you know, just appreciate your flexibility to get on the call today with me. And we'll talk again soon.
Sounds great. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
How many discounts does USAA auto insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/auto discounts. Restrictions apply. Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.